Partly cloudy skies at 86 degrees. Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Upon returning to the White House yesterday, President Trump denounced the actions of those responsible for the violence in Charlottesville.
Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans. We are a nation founded on the truth that all of us are created equal.
The president was heavily criticized for not immediately condemning the white supremacists and neo-Nazis who clashed with counter-protesters. Both Republicans and Democrats urged the president to be harsher in his condemnation. Now, Monday, Mr. Trump tweeted, quote, made additional remarks on Charlottesville and realized once again that the hashtag fake news media will never be satisfied. Truly bad people, close quote. Did the president move too slow? And what's the perception of that? And just how problematic is that for the Republican Party and other conservatives? Joining me in studio for a roundtable discussion are all former guests here on the program. Debbie Dooley, one of the original co-founders of the Tea Party movement, and Janelle Jones, Director of Community Affairs for the Georgia Republican Party, and Jake Evans, Executive Vice President of Atlanta Young Republicans. Thank you all for coming in and taking the time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Debbie, I'll start with you. Did the president wait too long in calling out these groups by name and denouncing their behavior and even ideology?
Well, you know, for the record, I believe that white supremacists are low-life scum. So I don't hold them. I mean, I have just cannot stand them. I despise them. But both sides were violent at the protest. You had the anarchist thugs that were there to disrupt the protest of the white supremacists. Mm-hmm. So both sides were violent. And I think the president called out both sides. I think I would have liked for him to call out and specifically talk about racism. It is just, you know, how horrible it is, and that this country was built on the concept that all men are created equal. But he did call out both sides. What I don't see is a lot of the Democrats actually calling out the anarchists for their part in the violence. And that's something I would have liked to have seen, too.
Why do you refer to them as anarchists?
Well, I think it's Antifa, and however you pronounce it. These are groups that are out there. They protested at the I Help Organize Nationwide Spirit of America rallies that mm-hmm. took place February 27th and March the 4th across the nation. And a lot of these thugs that wore masks, some wore helmets, and dressed in black were there to disrupt and cause violence at a peaceful demonstration. Look what happened in Berkeley, when people were exercising their First Amendment rights, and they were there to cause disruption. And there's been acts of violence all over the nation from these groups of cowardly thugs. And I would like to see them denounced.
We'll get to that in a minute. Janelle, did the president move too slow in calling out these groups by name?
I don't think so. Before I get started, I did want to make a small correction. I am the Community Affairs Director for the Georgia Young Republicans.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So that, put that, my apologies, Young.
Right. But I, you know what, the way I see it is I think he was making sure that he had all the information. It, immediately when it occurred, you know, it started out as a, you know, it's supposed to have been a peaceful protest, just expressing, you know, their rights. And then it kind of switched in a quick second. So I think he took his time to make sure he had accurate information. That's something he's been criticized for in the past, is being too quick to respond on issues. And so, you know, I was waiting to just make sure, you know, he did say something about it, which he did. He did, you know, call out David Duke, and, you know, and I will say that even his children.
Well, when did he call out David Duke?
Well, he called out the KKK, white supremacy, okay, you know, all that, you know, but, okay, and I will say that, you know, even his children were making comments and posting immediately when it happened. So I think as the president, we can expect him to make sure he has all the facts first.
Jake?
Sure. First, I appreciate the opportunity to be here, Rose. It's good seeing you again. As Debbie said, I think the most important thing at the inception is, as a Republican, to express really our unambiguous condemnation of what happened in Charlottesville. I don't think any Republican would advocate or support what happened there. I think everyone can pretty much agree that it's antithetical to the principles that America was built on, and it's something that we don't want to advocate. I also think it's important to note, as Debbie said as well, that there's radicals on both sides, and that's a very, very unfortunate reality. And if you look at the congressional shootings at the baseball field recently, and so to me, the more important question is not so much who is to blame for all this, but the more important question is how to resolve it. And I remember, you know, years ago when President Obama was in office, all of the criticism that he was increasing the gender, or he was increasing the racial divide, he was empowering Black Lives Matter, and regardless of whether that's right or wrong, the reality is here we are again, and I think there's a lot of criticism about Donald Trump empowering the white supremacists, which are people that should be condemned to the maximum extent possible. But I think it's more important to step back and think about how can we correct this. And to me, the answer is it starts at the micro level. All the leaders at the top level do influence those. The people that have the strongest influence are the parents, the teachers, the mentors, the educators. And so to me, the more important question is how can we help them understand the importance of teaching young people and old people the importance of inclusion, the importance of diversity, the importance of tolerance, because I think those are key principles that both Democrats and Republicans espouse and things that we want to keep promoting and furthering forward.
Jake, I want to stay with you for a moment because you mentioned teaching the principles of inclusion and diversity. I don't need to tell anyone at this roundtable that that's something that has been a challenge for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. Let's look at labels and definitions, because if you have groups that are rallying in protests, whether it's to keep a Confederate monument, and that group consists of self-identified white nationalists, white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and the KKK, and Janelle, I'm going to ask you, because you are a woman of color. Mm-hmm. We're talking about groups that believe they are superior mm-hmm. to other races. And in the past, mm-hmm. have lynched and killed and burned mm-hmm. crosses
yeah.
on people's yards. So can you understand if someone says, this is a group that's marching, and also align themselves with the current administration, whether it's fair or not, mm-hmm. can you understand the perception that this is an alignment with a racist group of people?
As far as the president being in alignment, or
just the perception
in general? Oh, well,
if mm-hmm. because these are the groups that are marching, and mm-hmm. at the same time in the past we've seen them while marching chanting Hail Trump.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that, you know, it's all about what you give life is what will continue to live. And so in this regard here, it's impossible to be able to control anyone and what they believe. You know, we're going to believe what we want to believe. Yes, I, as a woman of color, I do, you know, take offense to these groups on a different level. However, what I also know is that I believe they understood that by attaching themselves to President Trump and to this administration, that it's just another means of giving them life, because it gives media attention, it continues to push the agenda. If anything, sometimes the hardest thing to do is just to do nothing. And what I mean by that is, if you see that these are the groups that are out there, of course, emotionally, you want to respond. But at times, you have to realize that, you know, sometimes you just have to let them be. I personally don't agree that, you know, we should go and empower them by making the protest bigger, fighting, doing additional things. If anything, I feel that the best thing we could have done, well, for, you know, those who did go out there, was to just let them have their peaceful protest and keep moving. We can't ban protesting.
How peaceful is protesting if the protesters are carrying torches? Which we all know the history and symbolism of that. Debbie Dooley? And why shouldn't someone want to counter protest that, even if it's in a peaceful way?
They have every right to counter protest in a peaceful way, but we did not see that in Virginia.
But we do we know who started the clash?
I've seen a lot, and I've heard, I think the local police actually issued a statement saying that violence was coming from both sides. It was not just one side. And I don't believe for a moment they're attached to President Trump, no more than I believe that a lot of the violent Black Lives Matter protests, where you saw rioting and looting and the attacks on police officers, should be attached to President Obama. I can remember when you had five officers gunned down in Texas, and President Obama's statement was, well, we need to get all the facts to come in. He took his time making a statement condemning that. You did not see the widespread condemnation of him like you see with President Trump. Everybody has a right. Personally, if people I thought what would have done more to actually diminish these groups would be for people to counter protest and laugh at them and make fun of them when they started marching, is to ridicule them instead of being violent. The police, the police are culpable with what happened. I'm one of the national co-founders of the Tea Party movement. So we've had a lot of protest, even the Spirit of America rallies. And one of the things that has always been done at protest would be is that you keep the counter-protesters and the protesters with the permit completely separate. You don't mix the groups together. And the police officers had a stand down order. I heard a lot of condemnation about the way the police handled it from both the left and right. They herded these people together. They created a powder keg that erupted.
Jake, how problematic is this for the Republican Party if these groups, who are many of them Trump supporters and align themselves with Trump and the Republican Party, how problematic is that for the party?
Yeah.
Do you think it is?
I think that's a great question. And I think that question hits on a core concept, which is what you hit earlier, which is the danger of generalizations. You can't create and extrapolate and impute what these radical white supremacists did to a general everyday Republican, because they're not. I don't think there's any legitimate Republican that would say that and embrace these white supremacists as a part of our party, as a part of furthering what we believe in as a party. And I think it is very unfair, and I've seen it. I think, you know, Janelle and Debbie have both probably seen the reality that if you're a Republican, if you're a pro-Trump supporter, you know, you're a xenophobe, you're racist, you're intolerant. That's not true. And I think the people that say that create a very unfair position for most Republicans to be in. I mean, people that believe in fiscal responsibility, people believe that bringing the bottom up, not creating a system of lifetime dependency, but putting them in a position to help themselves, help them create earned success, and long-term job viability is what we're all about. We're not about these radical positions, and imputing that to us as Republicans is very unfair.
So given what Jake just said, Janelle, then what should the Republican Party do in terms of nationally denouncing these groups? You all have resolutions that you agree to during your convention. Is it now time for the Republican Party to officially denounce these groups and any affiliation with them?
Well, I mean, I believe that's what has been happening. President Trump and the administration has been denouncing these groups from the beginning. The fact is that, you know, because of free speech, we can't control what they say. However, I will say I do not believe, or I've never experienced a situation where the Republican Party has said that we are, you know, in support of these groups. So to say, is there a time to denounce it, is to assume that we were ever in support. But we were never in support of these groups.
Well, but sometimes a resolution may lend to the core of people out there who believe that you are afraid to lose this base, this support, because you haven't. well, officially denounced
it. Let's be clear, too, that the base is not as large as it appears to be. Based on research, that there is only about 1,600 major social media sites that are empowering these groups. So, I mean, when you think of the number of people here and the number of people that support the Republican Party, this is a very small group of people who we assume all support the Republican Party. However, I don't think it's something that, you know, like Jake was saying, it does not make up the majority of the Republican Party. What I will say is that I am an advocate of messaging. I am an advocate that the Republican Party can do better when it comes to messaging.
Okay, then when next year during the midterm elections, mm-hmm. then should candidates really then use that message of more of inclusiveness as opposed to mm-hmm. something like what we saw in Charlotte?
Well, I believe that a lot of times when Republican Party or candidates, we speak to all Americans. That is what we were saying as far as inclusiveness. Now, due to the fact that the Democratic Party typically uses identity politics against us, so that kind of forces the party to have to, you know, speak on specific issues. However, we've always been a party of inclusiveness as far as, especially when let's look at, you know, the African American community, and the Republican Party is assisting us and giving us the right to vote and being behind us, allowing us to have the right to vote. So
now,
what
but you're referring to a Lincoln Republican Party.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is different from the current Republican Party, Janelle.
That's debatable. Well, that's a little debatable. I mean, we have a little bit of both, however, but we can't deny history, because that's what this whole protest was about, right? So we can't deny history. So I will say that we have to just keep in mind that, you know, when it comes to inclusiveness, I will agree that we can, in lieu of what has happened, we definitely have to adjust our messaging a little bit. But, you know, we've always been a part of inclusion.
Debbie, Senator Cory Gardner, Republican from Colorado, tweeted, "Mr. President, we must call evil by its name." And then earlier today, my colleague Dennis O'Hare interviewed Georgia Republican Senator Johnny Isaacson and asked him this.
Other Georgia Republicans, though, including Senator Perdue and Congressman Barry Loudermilk, have denounced violence without naming white supremacists. So are you worried that the Republican Party, while it might not be co-opted by white supremacists, is at least in a place where some of its leaders might be politically afraid to confront them or name them?
Well, I don't think that's the case, first of all. Second of all, I think a lot of the press is making more of that particular vein of the subject than they should. That being said, everybody, as I said yesterday and as I said on the Sunday morning, the specificity of the denouncement of the Klan and white supremacists and Nazis should be without equivocation. There's no room for that in our country, and there's no room for politicians to allow it to exist.
Now, that's from a conversation listeners will hear Wednesday on Morning Edition with Dennis O'Hare. Debbie, you heard Senator Isaacson there. You agree?
I agree, but I don't think it's always necessary to, I mean, evil is evil. I thoroughly believe, and I grew up in the South, you know, when the KKK was out burning crosses as a young girl, and they're evil. I mean, David Duke, I'm from Louisiana. That is an evil man. David Duke is just, I'd like to ship him out of this country somewhere, but he has a right to be here. But what I would like to see happen is I would like to see the Democrat Party pass resolutions condemning violence of their fringe groups. For example, these counter-protesters. These protesters during the campaign that were showing up at Trump events, protesting, resorting to violence in New York City. I mean, a lot of hate. They were there protesting against hate, but you should have heard some of the things that they were saying. And as a Republican, and the Republicans I know, we have always judged people by their character, not the color of their skin. And that's something I think is very important. We have to respect each other's differences. But, I mean, evil is evil. But the Democrats and the mainstream media needs to call out evil on the left as well.
Can you give an example of when mainstream media has refused to call out evil on the left?
Well, the Berkeley protest, when Spirit of America Trump supporters were rallying.
Was there a loss of life?
There was not, but there were a lot of injuries that were there. Just because there's not a loss of life does mm-hmm. not mean it's okay. You know, oh, it's okay to be violent and loot and riot as long as you don't, you know, no one loses their life. There have been people injured. At the march in Virginia, these anarchists, these little cowards that hide behind black masks and black clothing, were actually throwing pepper spray and acid on people.
But you agree that we saw violence on both sides.
I agree, totally agree.
There was an African-American man who was chased into a parking garage that was beaten by six or seven of the other protesters.
Well, I was at, we had a Dixie, it's called Dixie Maggots, a meetup event we had Saturday in Atlanta from Trump supporters. There was a young man from New York City. He had a broken nose, his face was all cut up, and he was attacked in New York City because he wore a Trump hat. Mm-hmm. There are attacks like that going on that needs to be denounced as well.
You all agree that there is an issue here. Obviously, there is a problem. Mm-hmm. But because you all represent the Republican Party, which is why we invited you here today, what solutions do you have then? What recommendations do you have to your party? Because we are talking about your party and as it relates to Charlottesville, and because of the self-aligned voters who claim they're supporting Trump and who have been chanting Hail Trump. David Duke said, quote, "We're going to fulfill the promises of Donald Trump. That's what we believed in. That's why we voted for Donald Trump, because he is David Duke." And because of the other alliances with the neo-Nazis and white supremacists and white nationalists, you all recognize that's a problem. Mm-hmm. So what can you offer to your Republican Party to fix it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would speak for me as an African-American woman. One of the things that I am offering currently and what I will continue to offer is conversations around cultural diversity, making sure that we understand the differences that do exist. Yes, we are all Americans. However, there are certain specific issues that pertain to different ethnic groups, and making sure that we are mindful of that, that our messaging speaks to that, and just representing the party in a sense of inclusion, that's something that I definitely can offer and continue to do. Working with the Atlanta Young Republicans and the Georgia Young Republicans, you know, we are very committed to diversity and making sure that inclusion is on the top of our list. So that's a personal message for me that I will do on a micro level, as Jake said.
Yeah, no,
go ahead, Jake.
And I'll say there is hope. And the hope in that is, being a millennial, we are the most diverse generation in American history. Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up with more minorities than any previous generation. And so to me, the comfort with people who look different, who come from different cultural backgrounds, who come from different socioeconomic backgrounds, is much more heightened than maybe it was in the past. And so, not to say it is a generational issue, but I will say that I think moving forward, and this is one of the issues that you hit on earlier, given the changing demographics in America, with more minorities coming in, with the white base electoral vote likely decreasing, that does put the Republican Party in an interesting position.
Why?
I wouldn't say, well, because, as you've alluded to, the base is typically white. However, for the viability of the party, that can't and should not always be the case. And so, and my last point is, I think that I agree 100% with what Isaacson said. I mean, I think it should have been unambiguous condemnation of what happened. And I think, as I've said earlier, leading by example, leading through act, not necessarily words, which corroborates the inclusion, the diversity, the tolerance, is, in my opinion, the direction the Republican Party should continue to go in.
Debbie, I'm going to give you the last word.
Very simple. The Democrat party has neglected the inner city. I think Republicans should focus on bringing jobs and economic prosperity to the inner cities. Just because you're poor does not, and you live in a poor area, does not mean that you don't crave and dream of having a good paying job.
But Debbie, now you know there are poor rural communities too.
That there are, but you know, there are a lot of minorities and more in the inner cities, and I think that's what we focus on, bringing economic prosperity to everyone, to the inner cities, to all races, and give them economic opportunity.
As we wrap up, and I promise this is my final question, can President Trump, our commander-in-chief, can he be better in all of this in terms of the tweets, his narrative? If it's truly about unity, can he be better?
I think President Trump could walk on water and he would still be criticized because it's his policy. Yes, he can be better. But as a Southerner, I think most people find it hard to believe that a New York Yankee is racist. I mean, and associates with white supremacists or even condones that. I think he could be better in the tweets, but it doesn't matter. The mainstream media, he could walk on water and raise someone from the dead, and the mainstream media and left would still complain about it.
Janelle?
I would say that the mark of a good leader is the ability to grow and change and to look at every situation and find a way to be better. So I would assume that, or I would say that absolutely, you know, you can definitely always become better as a good leader.
Jake? Mm-hmm.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I think we all have room for improvement. I think that Trump comes from a very interesting background in that he's an outsider and he's not a lifelong politician. And for a lot of people, that change creates difficulty. But there's progress to be made, no doubt about it. I think, obviously, given the results of the presidential election, his messaging and what he proposes a lot of people agree with, and as a result of him trying to implement that, the media is always going to give him a very, very slim margin of error, which has proved to be true.
Blaming the media, Jake.
Not you, Rose.
Not you, Rose. You're great. Rose. We love you, Rose.
I don't know, Debbie. Debbie Dooley, one of the original co-founders of the Tea Party. Janelle Jones, Director of Community Affairs for the Georgia Young Republican Party. Jake Evans, Executive Vice President of the Atlanta Young Republicans. Thank you all for coming in and being a part of this important conversation.
Well, thank you for having us.
Support for WABE comes from Moncrief Heating and Air Conditioning. Since 1898, offering HVAC services to home and businesses for over a century and available 365 days a year when you need us. MoncriefAir.com. And from Peachtree Hearing in Marietta, Georgia. Dr. Melissa Wyckoff offers diagnosis and treatment for hearing loss, ringing in the ears, and dizziness or vertigo. More information online at PeachtreeHearing.com.
Community issues are what drives the conversations here on Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Tell me what's happening where you live. Send an email to rose@wabe.org. Again, that's rose@wabe.org. This is member supported 90.1 WABE Atlanta.
My name is Hawa and I live in Claxton. One thing I like about Claxton is a diversity city, and there is like many other people come from other countries. I have a lot of friends from different backgrounds. Like Claxton feel like to me is like an immigration cellar, like where some people from other country and you get to meet friends and get to know other people from other nation. If if I would change anything about classroom, I would change like about the school where I go. Like we have to have a new building and new stuff like this.
I'm Robin Young. As India marks the anniversary of its independence, a reporter reflects on his family's role in a law that led to a protest and a massacre.
The act that they were demonstrating against was written and named after a direct relative of mine, and you couldn't help but go there and feel shame and guilt about what happened.
Next time, here and now.
This afternoon at 3 on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. We're going to talk about honeybees. The decline of the bee population for years has concerned many environmentalists and beekeepers. Some believe the dwindling numbers was a sign that certain bee species could soon become extinct because of pesticides and habitat loss. But there's good news. Recently, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has reported that the number of U.S. honeybees rose 3% to 2.89 million this spring compared to a year earlier. Now, despite these promising numbers, researchers still have some concerns about the insects. And joining me now to talk more about it is Linda Tillman, president of the Georgia Beekeepers Association. Welcome.
Hi, Rose. I'm so glad to be here.
It's a pleasure. Now, full disclosure, there was a bee in my house this weekend.
Are you sure it was a honeybee?
I know my honeybees.
Okay.
I have two cats. Can I leave it at that?
I bet they had fun with the honeybee.
I'll leave it at that. Let's go back, because we've done a lot of segments on honeybees here because it was a real problem. But I want you to educate our listeners about the significant roles bees and other insects play in farming and agriculture.
Well, honeybees and other pollinators like butterflies and hummingbirds and bats are all pollinators. Mm-hmm. And what pollinators do is, in the process of visiting flowers for their own purposes, they carry the pollen from one flower to the next and, as a result, pollinate flowers and make them reproduce and have fruit if it's a peach tree, mm-hmm. or a cucumber if it's a cucumber vine. And one nice thing about honeybees is they go to their hive and they communicate. There's a great cucumber flower over in this direction. And so when the bees follow her direction to go to the cucumber flower, they only go to cucumber flowers. So that means she's carrying pollen from one cucumber flower to the next, another, which achieves pollination.
You know, a few years ago when it was first being reported that we saw this decline, and what was sort of your reaction to all this? Did you immediately think, well, it's due to pesticides or what?
Well, actually, the honeybee has been in decline since the 1940s. I have a graph that Dr.
far.
Jamie Ellis, who's from the University of Florida, gave me. It was put out by the United States Department of Agriculture, and we've been on steady decline since the 1945, and this graph ends in 2007, when the bees were going downhill and colony collapse disorder started in 2006, or at least the fear about colony collapse disorder started in 2006. So honeybees have been on decline. It's not any one thing. Mm-hmm. It's a huge amount of factors.
Well, there's some good news based on the figures that I talked about coming into this segment. So what do you attribute that to?
I expect a lot of that is due to the increased care of citizens about the honeybee. There are a whole lot more beekeepers, for example. In 2014, when Bear Kelly was the president of the Georgia Beekeepers Association, we had about 250 members. Now we have 900 members. So our increase in beekeeping membership, part of it is that we're doing a better job of publicizing in our organization, but a big part of it is that there's a push across the country for people to get into beekeeping. And it's a neat kind of way for an individual to feel like, hey, I'm doing something to save the environment.
And a lot of urban beekeepers. In fact, full disclosure, our own Susanna Capoludo is a beekeeper.
Yes, Suzanne has visited my bees in my backyard, and we've gone through bees together in the backyard at my house. And Suzanne is one of the many people who've taken up beekeeping as a hobby, but also as a way to contribute to society.
But you're not totally excited because there's still a long way to go. If you've been just told me that this has been happening since the 1940s, it's going to take a long way to stabilize that or even get it, if it ever gets back up to those levels again.
I don't think it ever will get back up to those levels again. Our agricultural practices in this country and our yard, just yard-to-yard practices are all about getting rid of weeds. So in the big commercial farms today, used to be bees had a feast. They could go around fields and there would be the weeds on the edges of the fields and there were lots of places to get food. But now when in the big commercial farms, they are weed free. And so if a honeybee is taken to California, let's say, to pollinate the almonds, those almond fields are full of nothing but almond trees. There's not a dandelion to be found. And in the yards that people have, we've had a sort of culture that says your yard is supposed to look like a golf course. And there's not a culture that encourages having clover and dandelions and things that bees love. And because of that, there would have to be such a huge shift, both economically on the big scale of agriculture and in a small way in the backyard. Now, I live in a part of Atlanta where I live in Virginia Highlands in Atlanta, and it's plenty of my neighbors have dandelions and clover and are not concerned that their yard looks like a golf course, which is kind of exciting. I can take my dog on a walk and see bees in every yard.
So there's an education process in terms of changing the mindset of you know, how you can still have that great looking yard and have something for the bees too.
Absolutely. There was a woman whose name is Michelle Colopy, who is head of the Pollinator Stewardship Council, who spoke to our October meeting of GBA last fall. And she lives in Ohio, where the law is that you can't have the grass in your yard be more than a foot high. So she got a seed company to develop seeds specific for her area that have no grass seeds of any kind in them. She took out all the grass in her front yard, planted her yard with these flower seeds. So she has a meadow of flowers in her yard that sometimes is a foot high but doesn't have any grass in it, so her homeowners association can't make her mow it down. It's that kind of rebellion, though, that it kind of takes to get this stuff going on.
Militant beekeepers, you, Linda.
Yes, we are.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Linda Tillman. She's president of Georgia Beekeepers Association about honeybees, kind of making a comeback after for really what some thought they might be extinct. Let's talk about someone listening saying, wow, Linda, you got me thinking, do I want to be a beekeeper? And then their spouse is saying, no bees allowed. But you know, what's your message to someone to say, you know, hey, you ought to try it?
I love being a beekeeper, and you should try it. There actually is a school in Atlanta, Springdale Park Elementary, that has bees on the roof of the school, and I'm the beekeeper for that school. And it's a terrific way for children to understand the importance of pollination, and the school's not worried about kids getting stung. That most parents are worried about, if I have bees, my children will get stung.
And for those that might have allergies to
yes,
them.
But it's very rare. Only 1% of the population actually has the kind of allergy that sends you into anaphylactic shock. But the truth about bees is they're really little peaceful little beings. And what they want to do is take care of their house. And so if I go and stand directly in front of the beehive and block their entrance to their house, that's going to make them mad. They're not going to be happy. And I'm likely to get stung. But I can go and stand out in my yard where I have several beehives. And I can stand off to the side and watch the bees fly in and out. And I never get stung.
How do you get started?
Well, it's an investment. It's not a cheap thing to do. You have to buy equipment, and it takes about $400 to get started because you need enough equipment to do two beehives. One should never start with just one beehive, and there's a good reason for that. Mm-hmm. Part of it is educational. You learn a lot by being able to compare the two hives. But the other is if something goes wrong, like if you lose the queen in one hive, you have bee babies in the other hive, eggs that you can put into the hive that lost the queen, and all of a sudden they can make a new queen.
You know how there's a Mr. Beer kit, so there's a Mr. or Mrs. Beehive kit? What does it come with, like a hive and a queen? What does it come with?
Well, actually, you can buy a beginner kit. I would not advise it, but I have a blog, actually, which is beekeeperlinda.com, and it has a list of what you need to get started in beekeeping. But if you want to get started in beekeeping and buy a kit, you're bound to get some useless items as well as some things that you really need.
Atlanta doesn't have too harsh of winters, so how much does, I guess, region and weather and climate play a role in all this, in being a successful beekeeper?
Well, weather and climate has a lot to do with it. I actually harvested less honey this year than I've harvested. I've been a beekeeper for 12 years. This was the least amount of honey I've harvested in 12 years because we had a whole lot of rain during what is called the nectar flow in Atlanta. The nectar flow is the time when the tulip poplar is blooming. So mm-hmm. that's typically somewhere from the beginning of April till the beginning of June. Somewhere in there we have a really intense tulip poplar bloom, and the bees go crazy collecting nectar. But we had rain a whole lot during that period of time. We had rain almost every other day and sometimes rain for days in a row. And even when it quits raining, it has to dry up a little bit before the bees can go actually get nectar and not mm-hmm. just raindrops from a flower. So we had very little nectar collection, and it's been a bad year.
How many different types of bee species are there, Linda?
Well, there are 4,000 in this country, which is a lot. And you'll, if you go to something, there's in many community gardens, people grow something called anise hyssop. Mm-hmm. If you go and look at a plant like that, you'll see so many different kinds of pollinators on it.
I promise I will not let my cats take out another honeybee
Good
ever
for you.
Again. But seriously, thank you, Linda Tillman, president of Georgia Beekeepers Association, for coming in and talking about this. Some good news, but still a lot of work to do.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Linda.
It was really a joy to be here, Rose. I listen to you all the time,
well,
so it's
you.
Nice to be a part of this.
And what's the name of that blog again?
My blog is beekeeperlinda.com, and you can learn all about bees also at the Georgia Beekeeping website.
All right. Thank you, Linda, so much.
Thank you for having me.
Buzz, yes, it's true. Buzzing all day long. So he sets off on his own with the bottle of cologne and the playlist of all his best tunes. Buzzing through the doors, the killers and the calls of the pyramids and Timbuktu. All the bees looked up as he came in to land on the Spanish golden sands. And then he sang.
Support for WABE comes from the Mathnasium Learning Centers of Atlanta, committed to the idea that when kids understand math, they enjoy it and do more of it, leading to mastery. There are 26 Mathnasium centers around Atlanta. Mathnasium, we make math make sense. And from SunTrust Private Wealth Management, whose teams of local financial advisors can help you look beyond the portfolio so you are prepared for whatever life brings. Confidence starts here. More information at suntrust.com/reserve.
This is Closer Look on 90.1 WABE. Did you miss some of today's interview? Don't worry. Catch each day's show at wabe.org/closerlook. Again, wabe.org/closerlook. Send our host, Rose Scott, an email, rose@wabe.org. There's more Closer Look ahead on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
Hi, my name is Ari, and I live in Mapleton. It's about 15 minutes outside the perimeter of Atlanta. I'd like for my neighborhood to feel more like a community, for there to be more of a sense of a connection in, you know, art, in style, in people, in their hearts.
My name is Teresa, and I live in Atlanta, Northroot Hills. I would like to see my neighborhood more alive, more sharing, and more as a family.
Hi, my name is Marcus Peju. I live in East Point, and I would love to see grocery stores closer to the communities instead of like Greenbrier and having to drive to like those shopping centers. So the closest grocery store is about 15, 20 minutes away, and it's just too far. You have to get in the car for everything. I would like to see it be more walkable.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. You all know since its founding, Morehouse College has had a mission to educate African-American men.
Out of the darkness that gave birth to a violent nation, there was a light. She came to teach the darker brother how to become a warrior of that light. She taught that his shield was the wisdom of his people, his only weapon, the spoken word. And most of all, she taught that his power was rooted in his ability to love. She, the light, amplified his agency, aggrandized his acuity, curated his consequence, and inspired an indelible integrity. And best of all, she used his training to build a base of brotherhood. Those that are familiar with this light call it Morehouse College. But to those of us that know our mother well, we simply call her home.
Mother Morehouse, that audio from a video produced by the college. The all-male liberal arts institution is in the process of searching for and then eventually appointing a new president. John Wilson stepped down back in April. William Taggart was then named interim president. Sadly, in June, he died unexpectedly. Since then, Morehouse alum and former secretary of the college's board of trustees, Harold Martin Jr., has moved into the interim role. Classes for the fall semester begin tomorrow, guys. And joining me now in studio is interim Morehouse College president, Harold Martin Jr. Interim President Martin, welcome.
How are you doing, Rose?
You're a Morehouse man.
I'm a Morehouse man.
You like saying that.
Proud.
Before we get into our conversation, just want to get your thoughts leading into what coming out of what happened this past weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia. Yeah. It took place on a college campus.
It did. I think I have a few thoughts. One is it saddens me that there are still groups that organize around thoughts of hate and separation and superiority. It saddens me that we're not able to express our views peacefully. And it saddens me that in that context, such groups would use violence toward people of difference as a manifestation of that hate. And then finally, it saddens me that there's anyone in this country, not the least of which, of whom being our leader, who would not immediately speak against that negativity. So it's tough to see that, and particularly on a college campus where our mission is to educate young minds, and I worry about the message that we're sending to the students at UVA.
And we talk about students and messaging, obviously that's the core of probably any institution, but when you talk about historically black colleges and universities, there is a core message there based on its mission, based on its history. And now you're in this interim role as president. Could be a short time, could be long term. In that time, what's your hope, what's your vision that you can bring as a leader?
Sure. So just to give you some context, Rose, so I graduated from college in 2002. Everything in my life changed the first day I stepped foot on that campus. Mm-hmm. Not visiting, but when I came, understanding the history, the tradition, the great men who had graduated from Morehouse, meeting our faculty and staff and my fellow students, for the first time I knew who I wanted to be. So you and others will use this term Morehouse man, but it's important to know what it means. Mm-hmm. And for me, what it means is there's an expectation of excellence around scholarship and leadership and service and being a person who's God-fearing and leading your family and leading within your community. And that's what binds all of us together. I graduated from the college 15 years ago, started working with our board 6 years ago, joined our board 3 years ago. So I'm long on Morehouse College, right? So what I'm here to do is we're stabilizing the institution and advancing the institution. So whether it's 2 days or 2 weeks or 2 months, mm-hmm. The priorities are the same, right? So we're committed to increasing our retention and graduation rate. We're committed to growing our enrollment. We're committed to enhancing our fundraising. We're committed to more effectively engaging our alumni. And we're committed to continuing to invest in our academic programming and co-curricular programs that make Morehouse College special. And to do all of that means that our board of trustees, our leadership, our faculty, staff, and students are all rowing in the same direction to achieve those goals.
You mentioned retention, improving graduation rate, enrollment, money, engaging your alumni. That's a lot. And any president of a college will tell you that their main priority is to also get some funding, increase those partnerships. Mm-hmm. And you know how critical that is for particularly HBCUs. In this short period of time, you have this list, but how do you prioritize it? And what's number one?
Yeah, great. So those are the priorities. So what you'll appreciate, Rose, is as you notice, I'm a relatively young guy, and I've got a lot of energy and a lot of passion for our college. I also have a broad base of support to move the college forward. So I think we can get a fair amount accomplished in a relatively short period of time. The other is, as I articulate these goals, I'm not talking about them in the context of my tenure of leadership.
Sure.
As a former trustee, we have a vision for where this college is going. So I see myself as playing the role as shepherd during a part of that journey, no matter how long that lasts. So I may not be the person closing out on each of these priorities, but the office of the president will be taking that leadership role, whether I'm sitting there or not. But to your point around fundraising, we are talking to donors every day. So every company, every foundation who is passionate about our mission, which is educating black men who will lead lives of leadership and service and who are committed to the academy, we're having that conversation with them. And what I find is I'm able to be very credible, not because I'm an interim role, which is, as you allude to, can be concerning, but because I'm a former trustee and I'm long-term committed to Morehouse College, and they know that when I'm speaking on behalf of the institution, not on behalf of myself.
Students come back tomorrow. You have a freshman class. When you talk to that freshman class, what points are you hitting? What are you stressing to these young men?
Yep.
Who are about to embark on, for what many believe, as you know, when you go to Morehouse, that's like you getting ready to climb that mountain.
No, it's game time. So we've had students, particularly our student leaders, on campus all summer. Our freshman class came in last Tuesday, was the beginning of new student orientation. And then our returning students came back this week, and we start classes tomorrow. When I'm talking to our students, there are some themes they'll hear from me every single time we talk. One is, we love you, we appreciate you, and we're glad that you're here. Because we love you, we are going to hold you to an extraordinarily high standard. And that is a part of what this journey is. When you step on our campus, if you haven't felt it in your family, if you haven't felt it in your high school, if you haven't felt it on your in your extracurricular activities before, you're going to know that on this campus we expect excellence from you. So that's one. Second is, we're going to be very specific about what it means to be a Morehouse man, and everything we do, our faculty, our staff, our leadership, the upperclassmen who you're meeting, our alumni, are very committed to you becoming that ideal. So they're going to hear that consistently. And the other thing that they're going to hear is, I graduated from the college 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I know what this is, right? The groomsmen in my wedding were Morehouse men. My business partners were Morehouse men. My mentors are Morehouse men. When I walk on that campus, there are memories that were formative for me. And so what they're hearing is, I'm not talking about this in theory, and I'm not talking about this in a nostalgic way. I know exactly what this experience is if you commit to it. And so I feel uniquely positioned to encourage them and hold them accountable to committing to it fully.
And then, that being the case, what's your message to the faculty and staff in terms of your leadership and what you expect of them?
Sure. So first step is, you can't talk at critical stakeholders, right? So I'm talking with the faculty. I'm talking with the staff. First message is, I want our team broadly to know where I'm coming from. I love Morehouse College with everything that I have, and I could not be more grateful to be there every single day. And it's important that our stakeholders know that, because that's the context in which we're having all these conversations. Second message is, let me give you a sense, as someone who cares about the college deeply and has spent a lot of time assessing where we are relative to a very rapidly changing higher education landscape, and give you a sense of what the priorities are in my mind. Mm-hmm. And I share those openly. Mm-hmm. And I also share the observations that I've had over the last now 8 weeks in this role. And I let that then be a context for a broader conversation about where we fit into it. We had a great day yesterday. We had an all-day faculty retreat. As you know, faculty are generally away doing research and mm-hmm. And the like during the summer. And so we came back and we had a full day retreat, and we opened that with some remarks as I just described. And there are a few things that our faculty are already committed to every day. And in fact, they're looking to me to make sure I'm as committed as they are. Mm-hmm. One is, are you committed to our core mission of teaching, research, and service? The answer is absolutely yes. And I see my role as removing barriers to them being able to do that effectively. And as we deepen on some of the priorities, Rose, that I articulated to you, there's a critical role that the faculty play in every single one of those, right? So their question to me is, well, Harold, what, you know, am I going to be able to play the role that I think I should be playing? Mm-hmm. A lot of times on academic campuses, the staff starts to lead the charge, when in fact it should be the faculty, right? So that's the conversation that we're having, is we're aligned in our priorities. They know where I'm coming from. I know what their goals are, and there's a lot of synergy there.
As we wrap up, there is another entity, and that is the Board of Trustees, which came under some criticism. You remember the Board of Trustees. You all have had some realignment there. How committed is this board now in terms of moving forward, getting past all this criticism in the past? Where are you all now?
Yep. So I won't speak for the board, because, as you know, I'm no longer a member of our board. What I'll say is that our Board of Trustees has been a tremendous partner during the 8 weeks that I've been in this role. And what I've seen from them is a commitment to excellence with regard to governance. And I've observed the changes that have occurred over the last several months. We have new board leadership that we did during this time of controversy, as you describe it, Rose. We have a new set of bylaws. We are shrinking our board. Our board is committing more financially, contractually, than they had before. And what I'm seeing is a better, frankly, partnership between the college administration, of which I represent, and our Board of Trustees.
Interim Morehouse College President Harold Martin Jr., classes resume. Start tomorrow.
Tomorrow. It's go time.
Interim President Martin, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Closer Look is produced by Candace Wheeler, Ebony Lemon, and Finley Foxen, and Amelia Brock. Our engineer is Elizabeth Eads. Our executive producer, Christine Dempsey. Special thanks to the entire WAB News team, as well as our digital services crew. If you missed any of today's show, you can find the entire program online at wabe.org/closerlook. And you can always listen to Closer Look weeknights at 9 p.m. We're back tomorrow at 1 for another edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.